that helped to put the Conservatives into power. And therefore, if there is an anti-Tory majority, we want to work with Labour and other anti-Tory parties to make sure the Tories are locked out of Downing Street.
I don't have to do a deal with you. I'll just put my Queen's speech there.
I was coming on to things because exercising influence in a parliament is not just about the Queen's speech. It's about how you exercise influence on a issue-by-issue, vote-by-vote basis throughout the entirety of a parliament. Now, I would say two things to that. Firstly, and this is important experience that the SNP could bring to bear. We've been a minority government. We know how it works. We know how to get things done. And we also know the way in which compromises have to be struck. So, you know, Ed Miliband can say what he wants right now. He's entitled to do so, but he can't deny reality. And if there is a situation after the election where neither of the big parties has a majority, then they will have to reflect how people have voted. And they will have to, on a practical level, be prepared to talk to and to compromise with others in order to get their policies through. Now, whether that's as part of a formal deal or an issue-by-issue basis, it gives parties like the SNP enormous clout and enormous influence.
But if we take this situation that we're positing just for the sake of this argument, that Ed Miliband was in a position where you also had some power, to whom would he have to speak? Would it be Angus Robertson, who led your party in the last parliament, or a putative successor, Alex Salmond, were he to be elected? Or would it be to you, somebody who's not even a member of the House of Commons, because you're not standing?
I'm the leader of the SNP, and therefore if there are, and again this depends on how people vote, if there are discussions to be had after the election, I'll be leading those discussions.
So you do the deal even though you're not in the House of Commons?
I'm the leader of the SNP, and people voting SNP in this election know that, and I don't think are under any illusions about that. The second part I was going to make in terms of a minority parliament, which I think offers huge opportunities, not just to parties like the SNP, but to people who want to see progressive change, is that under the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, it is possible for other parties to change the direction of a government without bringing a government down, and that gives enormous influence.
So what you've said very clearly is that if Ed Miliband had more seats than the Conservatives, he wouldn't have to do a deal with you, because what you would not do would be to prevent him getting a Queen's speech through. You've made it very clear.
What I'm saying is I don't want a Tory government. So I have said if there's an anti-Tory majority after the election, even if the Tories are the largest party, then I think the anti-Tory party should band together to stop David Cameron getting back into Downing Street to effectively lock a Tory government out of office. But then once a minority Labour government, if that's what we're looking at, is in place, then I say very clearly that the SNP would seek to use its influence on a case-by-case basis to effect the kind of progressive change that we want, to get an alternative to austerity, to have more protection for our public services. These are important matters that are important to voters in Scotland, but I think are important to many people across the UK as well. But we would do so positively and constructively. We're not going into the House of Commons with the intention of destroying or disrupting or bringing governments down. We want to effect positive, progressive change.
Right, an end to austerity. The Scottish Government, of course, at the moment under the arrangements, is funded by a block grant of around £36 billion, which comes on the formula from Westminster. And it is clear that in the choices you have made about spending, the English cuts have been more than dealt with by you in terms of your plans ahead. And if you just take the health spending, between 2009 and 10 and the current financial year, these are IFS figures, health spending in England rose by 6% in real terms. In Scotland, they rose by 1% in real terms. Now, who's the most austere?
Well, firstly, I know, and I'm very familiar with the figures you're citing to me, the Institute of Fiscal Studies figures. They exclude from that calculation non-profit distributing capital investment. Now, our capital budget was reduced by almost a third, so we had to invest in the NPD programme. Those figures don't include that, and that's the first point. Secondly, every single penny and more, I should add, of the what are called consequentials for the revenue budget of the health service has been passed on to the health service in Scotland. So we've done everything within our power to protect the health budget. And of course, lastly, health spending per capita is actually higher in Scotland than it is across the rest of the UK.
But it has not been protected to the extent that it has been in England, arguments about austerity.
I've just given you 3 points there that kind of rebut that
argument. It doesn't take it up to 6%
in real terms. We have passed on every single penny that's been available for the revenue budget of our health service to the health service in Scotland. Secondly, we've sought to supplement capital budgets by the non-profit distributing mechanism. And thirdly, health spending per head is higher in Scotland than it is in the UK. But we're putting forward as part of our anti-austerity argument the fact that we would vote for considerable increases in health spending across the UK to meet the terms of the Stevens report and to ensure that as we go into the next decade, the health service is properly equipped to face up to the challenges that it will meet.
Right. You've argued that you'll be a constructive member of the UK Parliament from, as you put it, an anti-austerity position. You don't believe that in the long term the UK Parliament should have sovereignty over Scotland. You want in the end to leave it. Why should anyone believe that you have an interest in making it work efficiently?
That's a very fair question, Jim, and it's one I always like the opportunity to address directly to voters outside of Scotland, because it's no secret I want Scotland to be an independent country. I argued for that in the referendum last year, and people in Scotland, having considered these issues, chose not to become independent at this time. So we remain part of the Westminster system, and therefore why, and I would say to people in Scotland that we can, outside Scotland, that we can be trusted is because as long as Westminster decisions affect Scotland, it matters to the SNP and it matters to Scotland that those decisions are good decisions. So we have a vested interest in making sure that the politics at Westminster is better politics because those decisions directly impact on the lives of people in Scotland.
Some would say that you've got a vested interest politically in a Conservative government because it would increase pressure from your supporters, who appear to be very numerous, for a second referendum, which you'd like, or one of your candidates
would. I'm not blaming you for this, take a very cynical view and say that we are driven purely by narrow party political interests. Actually, I'm not. I believe in independence. I hope the SNP does well next week. I'm campaigning hard for that. But fundamentally, first and foremost, what drives me are the interests of the Scottish people. And it's not in the interests of the Scottish people to have a Tory government. But while we are still part of the Westminster system, it is very much in the interests of the Scottish people to have better decisions coming out of the Westminster Parliament. That's why we will work positively and constructively for that. And in the process, we will benefit, I hope, people in Scotland, but also people in other parts of the UK who also, I think, want to see change. The polls say that neither the Tories nor the Labour party are going to win a majority. That says to me that people in other parts of the UK are as hungry for change as people in Scotland are.
But your rhetoric is one thing. The rhetoric of some of your candidates is quite different. Your candidate in Paisley and Renfrewshire South said the SNP presence in Westminster will be the rope the hung Parliament hangs on and we'll twist their arms. That's a rather different tone. But these are the people who are asking for the vote of the people.
Well, I can't make it and couldn't have made it clearer in this campaign, and I'll continue to do so for every moment that's left in this campaign to say to voters in Scotland, but also voters in the other parts of the UK, that if the SNP is a force in the next House of Commons, we will exercise any influence that Scotland chooses to give us positively and constructively, with the interests of Scotland very much in mind, but also with the interests of people in other parts of the UK in mind. It's a hand of friendship that we will be holding out.
Well, a hand of friendship. You know, there's been a hoo-ha about your candidate in the constituency of Edinburgh South because he compared people who voted no to Quislings, i.e. People in Norway who sold out their country to the Nazis, and saying, incidentally, that there were many elderly voters who barely knew their own names. You had to disown those comments in the Scottish Parliament the other day, although we noticed that he is still a candidate. He described in his Facebook page, the same candidate, MPs at Westminster, as paedophiles, tax dodgers, perjurers and thieves. Now, you say one thing, your candidates in many cases are saying something quite different and in a different tone.
I have said quite clearly that I condemn remarks like that, and I will continue to do so, just as I condemn the kind of abuse that gets hurled at me on Twitter and Facebook and such.
Sure.
Like, we should all lead.
But he's still a candidate.
And the voters will, you know, cast their verdict on him, as they will do with all candidates in less than 2 weeks now. But I, you know, lead by example in terms of the tone I expect to be set and the way in which I conduct myself in politics. And I'm in politics fundamentally because I want to see ordinary people in Scotland get a better deal from the political system. And that's what we will argue for in the House of Commons. And in so doing, I think we can bring something positive to the whole body politic across the entire UK.
Do you want a second referendum as quickly as you can?
No, I don't. I want to make sure that that decision is driven by what people in Scotland want. This election is not about a referendum or independence. You know, the SNP couldn't, I'm not saying we will, but even if we won every seat in Scotland, that would not be a mandate for another referendum.
So finally, as we approach an election only 10, 11 days ahead, and we look at what's happening in Scotland and we look at the likely balance at Westminster, historically, where do you think we may find ourselves on Friday the 8th of May?
This election is unprecedented in my lifetime and possibly even longer than that. I think what may happen is that voters reject the two-party Westminster system that tends to focus very much in the interests of one part of the country. And what we're seeing is the heralding in of a new age of multi-party, multinational politics. At Westminster, I think it could be a breath of fresh air for voters in Scotland, but for voters right across the UK as well.
Nicola Sturgeon, leader of the SNP, First Minister of Scotland in Glasgow. Thanks very much.
Now let's look ahead to start the week, which is